welcome to episode, I guess John said finally, of They Came From the North. I am your host for this episode, Andrew Forbes. Joining me, four of the most thrilling voices ever to grace a microphone. From across this vast continent, we have the wrong man, Steve Power.
Guten Tag.
The charming sociopath with an accent, Gabriel Gerard.
And bonjour.
And the icy and alluring blonde, John Mercer.
How do you say hello in Spanish?
Hola.
And I am the MacGuffin. All right, on tonight's episode, we will be discussing inarguably, the most famous director in the history of cinema. He is a technical innovator. He is a notorious perfectionist. He achieved both massive popular success and eventually overwhelming critical acclaim. He was both a passionate artist and a brand name recognizable for his distinctive style and mixture of suspense with gallows humor. His films have been endlessly dissected, their themes of obsession, isolation, voyeurism, guilt, persecution, and sex recombined countless times by younger filmmakers. His name has become synonymous with suspense, and it sounds like the tragic result of hastily putting on pants. I refer, of course, to Alfred Hitchcock.
Woo!
Woo! Woo! All right. He was born in 1899 in Leytonstone, now part of London, to Emma Jane Hitchcock and William Hitchcock, who was a grocer. His first jobs were as a draftsman and a designer, then as a contributor of short fiction to his employer's in-house publication, the Henley Telegraph. His introduction to film work came as a title card designer. His first few years as a director were plagued with false starts, disastrous productions, and audience indifference. In 1926, though, he directed The Lodger, based loosely on the case of Jack the Ripper. The film, which drew on Hitchcock's familiarity with and admiration for German expressionism, was a significant critical and popular success. The following decade of filmmaking proved highly successful, and in 1939, Hitchcock accepted David O. Selznick's invitation to move to Hollywood for a seven-year contract, pardon me, at Selznick Studios. From 1940 to 1963, Hitchcock rode an extended creative peak. While not without the occasional misstep, the 40s and 50s saw him produce a staggering number of now classic films. He continued to experiment with style and form, creating or popularizing a number of radical camera and editing techniques in the process. His post-1963 output, while less lauded, continued to display his drive to experiment and evolve. 1972's Frenzy, in particular, revealed that his supposed restraint in depictions of sex and violence were largely the result of studio mandates and social climate. His final film was 1976's Family Plot, a comic thriller starring Karen Black and Bruce Dern. His planned follow-up, what was to be 1979's The Short Night, was canceled due to his ill health, and he died in April of 1980 of renal failure. He was nominated five times for an Academy Award. Despite Rebecca winning for Best Picture of 1940, he never personally won an Oscar. In 1968, however, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences awarded him the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award for, quote, creative producers whose bodies of work reflect a consistently high quality of motion picture production. So in that spirit, let's get on with discussing the good, the bad, and the occasional ugly of the mumbling master of suspense and cameos, Alfred Hitchcock. So we're going to start, as usual, with the good. This is what each of us thinks is the absolute best, or at least our favorite, of the particular director's work. I am going to start with Steve.
I don't know
because
you're gonna do
that. I'm going to start with Gabe because Steve knew that I was going to do that, and I live to defy him.
All right. If I was to select what I consider to be Hitchcock's best movie, I would probably go with Vertigo. But my personal favorite out of those I've seen is Notorious with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. Notorious is about a woman whose dad has been caught as a traitor or as an attempted saboteur or something. And she's then picked up by the CIA to go undercover and to get in love with, well, to get close, to get
in love with him.
To get in bed with somebody who was suspected to be a Nazi collaborator, well, a German collaborator anyways, because this is after the war. What I like about Notorious is that it's very succinct. I find that it's very well contained, and there's not that many flourishes in it. It's a pretty simple picture, very well done, that runs like clockwork. It's very gripping. Ingrid Bergman is at her best and at her most beautiful. There's a lot of great little moments in it, starting with the famous kiss scene between her and Cary Grant, where I think Hitchcock wasn't them for kiss for a long time, but the ACE code wouldn't permit it. So he had them like talking and kissing intermittently, which made it even more erotic.
One thing I really liked about it was that Ingrid Bergman, like, it could just be the assortment of movies I've seen by her, but compared to most of her stuff, she's seriously damaged in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a side of her that you didn't often see, I think, at least after she became sort of a big star.
I mean, the movie starts and she just picks this guy she's never seen at the party and is like, I like you. And then starts driving drunk with him. You know, she's pretty reckless. And also her characters of a certain her moral standards are under questions. You know, mm-hmm. People keep referring to her kind of being a man eater, and they picked her because her dad was a traitor and because she gets along easily with men. So they're like, oh, it's going to be easy for her to get into his pants.
It uses her, like, the quality that she got used for a lot was this sort of vulnerability she had. And this seems to, like, Notorious makes it a lot more rounded than usual, because it's coming from a obviously damaged character who, you know, she's living with this legacy of her father being who he was, and she's clearly got alcohol problems.
Yeah, and I mean, what I like about it too is that it's fairly straightforward as far as Hitchcock movies go. I mean, there's not that many plot twists, and it's fairly all under the same room. It's very self-contained. But there's still moments where, the editing and the shooting are genius. Like when she gets the key and the guy gets to kiss her, and she wraps her head, hands around him, and she passes the key, like, around the back, her back, the way that that's handled, or the way that he keeps pointing that she's being poisoned by focusing on the teacup, and of course that famous scene in the wine cellar, which with the MacGuffin, and of course, I mean, I think it's one of the most striking endings too in the Hitchcock movies. It ends pretty abruptly with a pretty dark fate for one of the characters. And I think what I like about it is a certain purity, I guess I would say, because it is,
so direct.
It is very direct. It doesn't, he's not doing crazy camera tricks. It's just very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
It's very representative of his early work. Like, I think it's kind of a movie that really shows you what early Hitchcock was all about. You know, it's a good cross section of what he's done in that early period.
Hmm. Well, it's a very sort of lean thriller that's stylish without being burdened with too much. I think you could argue that sort of through the 50s, as great as some of those movies were, they were getting bigger and bigger and bigger until he really pared it down again with Psycho.
Yeah.
And Notorious is that just sort of tight, tense thing that moves along without, I mean, and obviously without compromising on the complexity of the characters.
And I've noticed as much as some of those movies are great, I tend to prefer Hitchcock when he's working in black and white, because his Technicolor is sometimes too garish, and like the fact that it's all on set and that is you using like rear projection for the driving scenes are more obvious in the color pictures.
Hmm.
I think it works really well in a double feature with the 39 steps as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All right. Is that it, Gabe?
I think that's all I have to say about Notorious. I mean, it's a really entertaining movie that does what it set us out to do perfectly with, you know, everybody in this cast being really great. I like, you know, that... you know, Cary Grant is used pretty well in this picture. He's not, I don't think Hitchcock always used him well, but in this one, he does it good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, moving on to John, because screw you, Steve. I hate this family.
My good, I chose to go with Strangers on a Train from 1951. For starters, I love the premise. You know, two characters, one likable if selfish, the other charismatic yet clearly disturbed, drunkenly discuss how much better their lives would be if a certain someone who was barring their way to happiness were to meet a sudden end, how they could both get away with it if they took care of one another's problems. After all, what reason would they have to be suspect? But while one of them laughs it off like a drunken jest, the other maliciously goes to work. And after his work is done, he expects the deal to be followed upon. And this leads to one of, if not the, in my opinion, all-time great suspense movies. It's probably the only time I've ever been interested in a tennis match. you could argue that Farley Granger is a little bit too dapper. He makes... he plays guys a little more than a fop, but to me that works even better in the movie, because you got this guy who's he's pretty much a pampered tennis pro, and he's just dragged
out of his league.
very out of his league and dragged to some very dark places. Especially, you know, once you get to that tennis match part, once it's he's trying to match wits with somebody who's obviously a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Walker, the guy who plays Butch.
Bruno?
Bruno, not Butch. What the fuck am I saying?
Butch.
I've been drinking.
Butch Haynes, tennis pro. I wish guy's name was Butch.
Now, what was Bruno's last name? Because Butch is a great name for a playboy, too.
Bruno Anthony.
Yeah, that'd make the manicure scene even better. But he's dark and Cheshire, you know, instantly charming, but possessed of an insidious nature that lurks just below the surface. Interestingly enough, he died mere months after shooting Strangers on the Train. I think it was about 8 months later.
Yeah, it was very soon after.
Yeah, which is much like another favorite movie villain of mine, Yusaku Matsuda from Black Rain. But Strangers on the Train, to me, it's a deceptively layered film. It's got this a really simple premise, albeit one that I'm amazed they haven't copied. Well, it gets copied for television shows all the time. I'm really amazed nobody's ever attempted a remake of it.
Yeah, well, there's Tomama of the Train, right?
That's not a remake, dude.
Well, it's basically the same thing.
I'm really, really surprised DJ Caruso didn't put Shia LaBeouf in a remake of it a few years ago. But, you know, it's got a really simple premise that just hides rich thriller sequences. It's hard to top them 60. God, no, it's more than 60 years, isn't it? After it was released, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a devout Alfred Hitchcock fan, but I'm Strangers on a Train is one of those movies for me. If I catch it on TV, I have to sit down and watch it. Mm-hmm. It's one I'm amazed I don't own, actually.
And talking about the ending sequences, that old sequence around the carousel is very memorable.
Mm-hmm. With the carny crawling underneath. Like, I don't know what they paid that guy.
Nothing.
But it wasn't enough.
I'll get you into movies, son.
Your life's been terrible up to now. Do it.
You'll be in the pictures.
I like to think that this movie, at the end, it drove Farley Granger insane, which led to Prowler in the 80s.
Oh, my God. He was in Prowler. Why haven't we done Joe Zito yet? He did one good movie.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, Strangers on a Train is one of my favorites. It's not my good, but it almost was. And, like, if it had nothing else going for it but Robert Walker's performance, it would be a really solid movie. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, on top of that, it's just a ton of really ingenious touches. And, I mean, like you said, the tennis match, just as a visual concept, Bruno sitting in that crowd as they're looking back and forth following the game. And also, it's one of my favorite performances from Patricia Hitchcock as Barbara, who she's the younger sister, I think, of the main romantic interest. And she's got that scene where she's sort of hypnotized by a lighter.
The lighter is awesome. I didn't want to throw out too many spoilers because it's an amazing movie, right?
Yeah. And hopefully I'm not spoiling it too much. But
and I'm serious. I don't think there's any of the TV shows in the Law and Order vein. I don't think any of them have had a series run without doing the Strangers on a Train episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like you said, it hasn't been, at least as far as I know, it hasn't been directly remade, but it's such a good concept that it's been referenced a number of times.
Yeah.
Strangers
on a Train. But for anyone who hasn't seen it before, there's not enough words to describe how good Robert Walker is in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's Kevin Spacey wishes he was this menacing.
Yeah. I feel like Robert Walker is the proto Kevin Spacey, and Kevin Spacey's just been modeling his entire career off of this performance.
I sit down watching, and I'm like, I think this guy was probably the Black Dahlia killer, right? He's this actor could very possibly have led a double life as a serial killer. This is how disturbing he is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, that's just bizarre. On Robert Walker's page, there's a picture from Star Trek with William Shatner shirtless. Go IMDb. Robert Walker died in 1951, but whatever.
My mask of sanity begins to slip.
All right, Steve.
Well,
what is your good for Alfred Hitchcock?
I wanted to go with, originally I always kept going back to the 39 Steps, which is a great movie that I love.
Fantastic movie.
But I got to go with a more iconic, a more well-recognized Hitchcock film, and that is 1959's North by Northwest.
Yes.
There are so many set pieces and like little action set pieces and stuff like that. Just like so much going on in this movie that would color and, you know, influence everything that came after, like James Bond, Indiana Jones, you know, like so much of that stuff can be kind of traced back to North by Northwest.
It really is like in some ways the first James Bond movie.
Yeah. It's got, but it doesn't have the inherent you know, kitschiness that comes with the James Bond movies, mm-hmm. the early James Bond movies, you know? It's just, it's a lean flick. It moves like stink. Cary Grant is absolutely, like, he's in his element here. He is absolutely fantastic. You know, it's not my favorite Grant movie. That honor would go to Charade, which some would argue was a Hitchcock movie anyway, even though he had nothing to do with it. But, you know.
Shut up,
darling.
Can we also just add, watching this movie, I watched this one again last week. Yep. Cary Grant has the most heroic jaw I've ever seen. Like, seriously, this guy has got the prototypical action figure jaw, the mighty cleft in the center of it. And
I kind of wish he'd played Superman.
Yeah.
In 1939.
There's a reason the guy was, you know, like, one of the first of the real Hollywood royalty as we see him today, you know. There was him and Humphrey Bogart and all these guys who came up in those few, like those eras, the 1940s, the 1950s. And, I think he earned it. But you see a movie like North by Northwest, and yes, it's a Hitchcock film, but it's Grant's show too, you know?
Yeah.
It really is a collaborative picture. I don't think that Grant and Hitchcock had the same relationship that Hitchcock had with a lot of his other actors, you know? Like, I think it was almost more of a, there was more of a give and take. And I think that shows on the screen. I think that really, I think that helps Hitchcock a little bit as well. It keeps him,
Grant was the kind of guy who, you know, he could follow exact directions in terms of where he was standing.
Yeah.
And this and that, like Hitchcock wanted, but he had enough charm and he threw enough small details into his performances.
Yeah, he had the
charisma.
He could
improvise within that really restrictive.
Yeah. Right, yeah, like, same with Jimmy Stewart, Hitchcock.
Like actor house cats, you can't stay mad at them. But no, North by Northwest, I mean, the movie is just phenomenal. It moves whip fast, and I love that, you know, well, of course, everybody loves the Rushmore sequence. I mean, it's handled really, really well, shot beautifully, you know, like really, really nicely, just all around great movie. I can't really – it's not a movie that opens itself to an analysis, I find. Like, I mean, I've seen stuff where people kind of – try to read more deeply into it and stuff, but it's a rousing action adventure movie. It's not it's not art. It's you know, it's a blockbuster. It's
great. Well, I mean, I would argue that it sort of elevates that to art.
Yeah,
in just how much care and ingenuity went into the direction of it.
And that's the thing. It's a technical piece of art. You know, like from a technical standpoint, it's a piece of art. But from a plot narrative standpoint, I mean, it is, you know, it is what.
As deep as it gets is some sex jokes.
Yeah.
it's a great movie. I mean, I can't really say anything beyond the fact that it's a great movie. And, you know, if there are only two or three movies out there that earned Hitchcock his reputation and they're all of the same caliber as North by Northwest, then that's a reputation well earned.
It's also one of those movies that, you can tell that Hitchcock structured it and sort of came up with the whole thing, but he also had a screenwriter who was the perfect fit in terms of finding the balance between humor and suspense.
Yeah.
For it. It was Ernest Lehman, right?
Yeah.
I think? Yeah.
Yeah, I would add that to Notorious as well. It really straddles that line perfectly between the flighty stuff and the suspense part.
And I find that is kind of, like, with Hitchcock, I find, especially with his earlier films, I find that is kind of a weakness of his. I find a lot of his humor is just so – he's got such an offbeat and quirky sense of humor that a lot of his stuff kind of – like early on, his attempts at overt humor do kind of fall flat. Like when he's not being completely subjective, you know, when he's actually like, oh, this will be a funny scene to throw in there. This will be a laugh, you know. I think that's when he kind of fell a little bit.
Yeah, I would accept that. I mean – for example, I think that The Lady Vanishes is one of those movies that has more of those moments that sort of try to be like, oh, let's have a funny little moment here, and it derails it a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
That was an unintended pun on the rail theme. I really didn't intend that. I only realized.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that last shot in North by Northwest. Symbolism.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But just while we mentioned Lady Vanishes, that's probably the best Agatha Christie adaptation that I've seen that is not an Agatha Christie adaptation.
I like the movie, don't get me wrong. But
Can we also mention just how much better North by Northwest is than Eagle Eye?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did we have to mention that?
Oh, Shia LaBeouf.
Oh, DJ Caruso. You rep Skelly in you.
Oh, Disturbia.
Getting punched in the kidney. No, but Disturbia had David Morse.
Everything has David Morse.
Okay, Disturbia had David Morse playing what he really is.
Oh, fair enough.
All right, Andrew. All right.
I am going to go for my good. I'm going for one that's, I would say, definitely on the other side of the line. It's not a rousing adventure. It is more of the Hitchcock going serious, although it's got quite a bit of humor in it as well. That is Shadow of a Doubt, nice. Which he described wonderfully as bringing murder back into the home where it belongs.
Why didn't you say that in Hitchcock's voice?
Because I can't do Hitchcock's voice.
Bringing the murder back into the home.
Bringing murder back. See, my mouth is not comprised entirely of marbles.
I just took a handful of peanuts.
Marbles and gelatin.
I feel like Hitchcock was his entire life was a personal challenge to see if he could keep an entire pint of saliva in his mouth at all times while speaking. Shadow of a Doubt, yeah, it's, again, I would say it's not as high concept as Strangers on a Train, but it has a really good concept, and that's what if you discover that someone in your own family may or may not be a murderer. And it involves Teresa Wright's character, she's a young girl or young lady in a everyday average sort of California home. Her uncle comes to stay with them, and we know, or at least we're heavily led to suspect, that he is a nefarious character. And over the course of the movie, she starts to question whether or not he is the person that certain detectives are out and about looking for. It is such a good movie, and it is entirely, I don't want to say entirely, but it is helped immeasurably by Joseph Cotten's performance as Uncle Charlie. He is absolutely amazing in constantly having an undercurrent of menace, even when he's being very friendly and bright and cheerful and happy to see everyone. He can turn with just the slightest change of expression, and immediately you get this strong sense of menace. He is sort of the focus of the story. There are a lot of nice side characters, though, that are worth mentioning. I think probably the best... one of the best uses of humor as of ongoing gags in any Hitchcock movie is the friendship between young Charlie's father, played by Henry Travers, I believe, and the neighbor, played by Hume Cronyn. They have a sort of constant going back and forth, trying to figure out how they would get away with murder, the perfect crime, and they're sort of having these conversations out on the porch that are quite amusing, and at the same time they're completely clueless to the fact that there's sort of genuine drama and horror going on right in front of them. So it's got a great balance between humor and suspense, and it's a very interesting central relationship between young Charlie Teresa Wright and Uncle Charlie. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting dynamic between them. You learn early on that she's always, she's obviously Uncle Charlie is her namesake. She's got this close connection to him. She's always felt like somehow she's an outsider among her immediate family, and maybe that he's the one that she should really be connecting with. So when it comes time that she starts to suspect him of being a really rather horrible person, there's an interesting tension that goes on. It's also really well shot. The locations are fantastic. but not in a – it's in a very unobtrusive way that it's shot. It's – I would say probably in this period when he's already firmly established a very distinctive style, it's one of his less overtly stylized movies, but he's clearly entirely in control in terms of managing the emotion of the audience and all of the various tensions that are going on. So yeah, it's really, really good.
And speaking of analysis, I couldn't really stop myself from, when I was watching the movie, from viewing the relationship between Young Charlie and Uncle Charlie in a darker term, because he's like, it'll be your secret, do not tell your parents, and stuff like that. And, you know, viewed to a modern lens, it almost sounds like a kind of incestuous
relationship. Certainly, I mean, in terms of, I mean, he... Definitely with the language, the fact that she's sort of right on the brink of womanhood, I guess, if you want to use that term, and he is obviously sort of exerting some kind of strange power, and they've got this, you know, it's all about the special relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's something that Hitchcock undoubtedly knew he was putting in there. I don't think he necessarily meant to... directly suggested in the sense that the audience was supposed to understand it even as it passed the Hays Code. But I think he was sort of seeding that as one of those extra tensions and one of those strength quirks of their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it adds to the general malaise of the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. And this is probably one of, I mean, I'm sure people could come up with examples to argue this, but I would say it's probably one of the first mainstream examples of sort of under the white picket fence, sort of all the ugliness that's in this supposedly idyllic, you know, long, long, long before Blue Velvet, you had Shadow of a Doubt that was saying, yes, on the surface, this is all wonderful and beautiful, but, you know, all of those horrible stories you hear about people murdering people, it's ordinary folks.
but at the same time, Uncle Charlie does come from outside. He's an invader in the idyllic society. And you don't really see anybody else doing bad stuff in the suburbs, you know?
You don't, but he comes from that. He's got that relationship with the mother who obviously has some, I guess you could say, emotional frailties. You get the sense, I think he's sort of introduced to suggest that these qualities in slightly more benign forms are still there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also wanted to mention, I love the very first scene, which is just him lying alone in this room in New York, I think. And you get the sense that it's like, you know, Quint in Jaws talking about a shark having those doll's eyes. And he's just sort of got this sense of sort of being a void, and just sort of sitting there waiting.
It reminded me of Le Samurai, actually.
Oh, there's that too, yeah. Anyway, Shadow of a Doubt. I recommend it. I don't know if Steve or John wants to say anything about it, or should we move on to the bad?
I haven't seen it in a while, but, you know, I enjoyed it. It was good.
It's one of those movies that on the second viewing, I enjoyed much more.
I can see.
I haven't watched it in about 10 years, so I don't really know if I have much more to add.
All right. Moving on to the bads. At this point, I will remind our vast, vast population of listeners that bad does not necessarily mean the movie is entirely a bad movie. It's the sort of ambitious failures or maybe not so ambitious successes. The ones that exist somewhere in between good and ugly have some problems, have some things to recommend them. So I am going to shock everyone by starting with Steve.
This one's a much tougher one for me. I'm torn between a few. Big surprise, big surprise. I originally was thinking Rear Window. But,
interesting.
But I couldn't honestly pick Rear Window, because Rear Window is
fucking amazing.
I see it as bad because of how many times it's been imitated and ripped off, remade, recycled, you know?
It's just kind of unfair.
Yeah, and that's why I can't do it. I can't, because it is a great movie. It really is. I probably would have to go with To Catch a Thief, 1955.
Oh, that was one of my choices. So now I
that is my
I don't
choice.
Have to choose that one.
I like it. I think it's a great movie. You know, I think it's enjoyable and all that sort of thing. But I think as a Hitchcock film, I think it feels more like, you know, just a Cary Grant vehicle. It feels, you know, more like a one of those classic Hollywood. Light, fluffy, breezy. I don't know.
It's a trifle.
Yeah. It's kind of a lark, you know. And whatever they did with their relationship in North by Northwest, I think with The Catch a Thief, I don't know if it's that Hitchcock's star hadn't risen at that point yet or what. I'm not sure, but he seemed to have considerably less control over what was going on screen. It seemed to be like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the politics behind the movie, but it seemed like there was a lot more of just, you know, that typical Grant Kelly back and forth, you know. And I guess, you know, like, to an extent, that's probably exactly what the studio wanted, but it just doesn't feel like a Hitchcock film to me.
I mean, it seems like it was definitely designed to be sort of one of those travelogue, like, let's show people in America and in the UK, the south of France, and you know, there's that ball sequence in the middle of it, so it's like, oh, nice costumes, we'll show off some Edith Head costumes. Clearly designed to sort of be a glitzy star vehicle that didn't have a lot of weight.
And I mean, but it was my choice for Bad too. By all accounts, I should love this movie. It's basically Alfred Hitchcock doing Arsène Lupin.
Yeah.
But what's really missing from it, I find, is you know.
Actual thieving,
and I mean, there's a way that Hitchcock can be light and still be suspenseful, like in North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I find To Catch a Thief, it's kind of there, you know. It's not really engaging you. It's just beautiful to look at, and there's no point where you actually care about what's happening or on screen, or no real sense of excitement, you know.
He doesn't really define the players who could be sort of the other villains in it.
No.
I find, you know. Obviously it's revealed at the end I'm not going to spoil it, but there's sort of a twist reveal. And there weren't really enough, there wasn't enough, I guess, I don't know, I don't want to say there wasn't enough misdirection, but there weren't enough elements there to sort of draw the audience's suspicions really invest you in the...
And it feels like it should be more fun than it is, you know, with that kind of basic plot and stuff. I was thinking about the Arsène Lupin comparison, and I'm like, was thinking that the John McTiernan and Thomas Crown affair, you know, is a much more is actually more successful in trying to do that kind of movie, you know.
There's a great line in it where Grace Kelly says that Cary Grant. You know, he is pretending to be someone. She says he's like an American character in an English movie. He's not convincing. And that's kind of the sort of disconnect that I get with the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is it's this sense of, you know, it's trying to be this sort of complicated blend of comedy and suspense, and it's just not quite convincing.
Like I said, it feels to me like the actors are just kind of, you know, let off the chain. It feels to me like they're having a bit of fun. They're making their little... You know, their vacation film, and there's not really anything.
So it's Ocean's 11.
Not even Ocean's 11.
I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah, Ocean's 12.
Yeah, more like Ocean's 12, because Ocean's 11 is actually fun.
And the equivalent to Ocean's 12's only highlight, which was Vincent Cassel basically like doing amazing dancing through lasers, is the fireworks show and all of the amazing lighting that goes into that scene.
Yeah.
And especially that one shot where Grace Kelly's entire face is in shadow and the only thing lit is the necklace around her neck.
It's completely done and everything, but I haven't seen the movie, but to me it feels like what the reviews for The Tourist were saying. That's what To Catch a Thief is.
And I think the tourist was trying to be To Catch a Thief. It was like, let's get two huge stars and send them to France or Venice or whatever. And that alone will carry it.
It was done so much better, what, 10 years later? Charade.
Yeah, Charade is how you do that movie.
And I'm so surprised.
Charade also had Audrey Hepburn. It was delightful. Audrey.
I'm surprised that it pops up so often in lists of Hitchcock's best movies, because it's not that great, I find. I mean, I want to
see what it would be like with a Henry Mancini score.
Yeah, there we go.
And Walter Matthau.
It's funny because Hitchcock, you know, he was so precise and everything, but that movie kind of feels like it needs trimming somewhere, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little fat around the waist.
Just like Hitchcock.
Just like me.
Wow.
It's no, nice. It's
sports movies.
Hitchcock was a lot faster around the waist.
Okay, do you feel like you've said what you want to, Gabe?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, John, what's your bad?
This one was really hard for me, too, because I like a good bit of Hitchcock. The ones I don't like, I like dislike enough to be ugly. So I had to find a middle ground, and that's why I went with 1966 Torn Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I chose this as my bad is that it plays out for me as Hitchcock's most visually pretentious piece. It's, you know, at its core, it's just the cheapest bargain basement spy thriller. And he breaks out all of his toys and visual tricks to try to elevate it through sheer force of will. And it just, something is missing.
Yeah.
You know, what hurts it the most for me is that the most interesting part of the movie, the whole, you know, is he or is he not defecting to the Soviets angle, is resolved pretty much at the end of the first act.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it just becomes utterly vanilla. You know, the characters in the story, he smothers them in set pieces that just borrow heavily from movies from his earlier catalog. And there's a false sense of tension by he makes it really claustrophobic. He never gives the two leads, and by extension the audience, never lets them up for a breath of air. You know, like for most of the movie, Paul Newman and Julie Andrews are both, you know, constantly supervised by Soviet spies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never really, I know it's supposed to make it feel tense, but
It just doesn't really give it anywhere to.
Yeah, the tension
stretch its legs
no way to build, right? Because it's not moving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just. It's not a terrible movie, but it's just, you know, those type of spy movies, especially by 1966, were a dime a dozen. And I was really hoping that an Alfred Hitchcock movie with Paul Newman, which are two things I enjoy, would be a lot better. And it's disappointingly plain.
Yeah. I mean, I remember
it did give rise to one of my favorite Hitchcock quotes, though. When Newman asked him, "What's my motivation?" And he told him, "Your motivation is your paycheck." No time for method.
Surrounded himself with professionals.
Yeah. I remember watching it, and I think, you know, I'd probably come into it with a lot of people sort of trash-talking it, and I remember having more fun with it than I thought I would, but it was like everything you say definitely applies. Like it's not at all one of his heavy hitters.
No, I went into it expecting, because it's an Alfred Hitchcock movie, and again, it's Paul Newman in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And you compare this to, I think Harper came in around the same time as this.
Harper was, I think, 71.
Was 71?
I think, yeah.
Okay, so all right, so Newman wasn't quite doing Old and Tired yet, but. He's
not really a Hitchcock compatible actor, though. No, as you alluded to.
Yeah, Newman is new school. Very much new school.
Yeah. And I thought I was really going to like it. I love defection stories. And this one kind of, you know, turned it on its ear a little bit because it's, you know, it's somebody going to the east, or so you think.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's just they burn through that too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of lays the cards on the table, you know, before the movie's even halfway through. And then it's just, you know, chase sequence. Let's set something on fire and.
It does have, however, one of my all-time favorite Hitchcock shots, which is that close-up of the woman stabbing at the camera. They're out at this house, and there's the supervising guy, and they have to get rid of him. And it's this sort of like manic sort of stabbing at the camera thing that I remember I used to see in like – sort of compilation trailers for like the work of Alfred Hitchcock. There would be this shot of this woman sort of stabbing at the camera.
Yeah.
And it was always kind of like, oh, that's awesome. But you know,
and it's just,
a good shot is not a good movie.
You know, and I'm not going to, I hesitate to throw out spoilers, especially for Hitchcock movies. Cause there's, there's a lot of twists involved.
Mm-hmm.
Harper was 66, John, by the way.
66? Yeah. Oh, I was... Boom! Maybe 71 was Drowning Pool.
75 was Drowning Pool.
Jesus. 9 years
later. I just thought Harper was much closer, that's all.
Yeah. Man, Paul Newman got old fast. Seriously, man. No, Harper, he looked like he was 50.
I don't know.
I also didn't like a lot of the film's climax just revolves around petty spite by an entirely ancillary character.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And just that felt to me like a Deus Ex Machina moment.
Yeah. It's definitely a lot of obvious contrivance.
No, it's not a bad movie. It's It's Greek yogurt.
Why Paul Newman got old so fast? Because he started every day drinking a bottle of salad dressing.
Bottle of Kentucky bourbon.
All right. I'm going to move on to my bad. I'm struggling with this too because there are...
Because we're film snobs. We love
there were a few. Yeah, I mean, I think probably I am going to go with... Wait for it. Where is it? I can't remember the title. I'm looking through the things. What is it called?
This is how much I just don't care about this movie.
I confess. Yeah. I confess is one of those movies. It would almost get to good for me. It's got a great premise, which is that someone commits a murder confesses it to his priest in a very sort of – whoa, what was that? That was either a very loud but sort of – I don't know. It was like a fart / zipping up a suitcase at once.
So somebody is satisfied.
Yeah. All
right. It was actually me tipping my mic.
Oh. This guy commits murder. He confesses to the priest. He counts on the fact that the priest is bound by his principles not to reveal what's been confessed, and then he implicates the priest in the murder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great concept. So the movie is sort of taken up by this kind of moral dilemma of knowing that someone is a murderer and but being extremely devoutly stuck with these sacred principles, not being able to reveal what you know. Montgomery Clift plays the priest. It takes place in Quebec City. The locations are gorgeous for anyone who's ever been there. It's a very, very attractive city, and Hitchcock really makes the most of it. And it's an interesting case of a method actor working very well in a Hitchcock movie. I am sure that Hitchcock and Clift wanted to murder each other after very little time, because they're just completely incompatible. But they managed to sort of, I guess they sort of maintain some sort of tension where you get all of Hitchcock's control and all of Clift's, all of the best things about Clift's approach to acting. So you get a very naturalistic, an unusually naturalistic performance from a lead in a Hitchcock movie. I think it falls apart in a couple of areas. One is a really sort of trivial thing for most people probably, but it's just that, you know, you have Carl Malden as the inspector, and clearly none of these people live in Quebec City. As someone who's lived in this country, it's just kind of like, and that's just cultural bias. It's like, yeah, I mean, I know none of you are really living in this city, but that's sort of a minor problem. You can get over that really quickly.
Well, that was explained, wasn't it?
Oh, was it?
Quebec didn't have their own police force at the time that this movie was made, so they brought all their cops in from Ontario.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm being facetious.
You're not being facetious very well. I was confused. I'm gullible.
You actually believe that Quebec didn't have a police force?
I was just kind of like, what is he talking about?
That's how the biker gangs got a foothold.
That doesn't make sense at all. But no, but I thought you were saying that it was actually explained in the movie. I was like, I don't remember that.
My biggest problem with it, I hate the glaring, like the totally glaring hysterical inaccuracy. Clearly, nobody was murdered in Quebec City until 1972.
Oh, really? What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. I mean, the big flaw with it, I think, is that the treatment of the villain and the way it's resolved doesn't feel as natural as I think in some ways. Montgomery Clift is so believable, and he is sort of the core of the movie, and he's such a real person that when you suddenly have the obvious machinery of the thriller going on in the background, it's kind of jarring. You have this strange mix of kind of naturalistic human drama and then some very... You know, it's not a badly written movie, but some very obvious resolutions through screenwriting. But I want to emphasize again, it is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. And there's a great sequence early on where Hitchcock cuts between these shots of street signs that are pointing in different directions. So it's like, you know, the camera's following these directions and ends up at the scene of the murder. And, you know, there aren't as many sort of obvious touches like that throughout the rest of the movie, but it's a beautifully stylized, beautifully shot movie. And that is why it's not an ugly or a good. But now we're moving on to ugly.
I'm just going to add one last thing about...
Oh, okay.
Sorry, about I Confess. This is actually a conversation that myself and a really good friend of mine... cheers, Mr. Kevin Woolridge. Kev's been doing a lot of theater work lately, locally, and we've been talking about, like, a lot of the... like, these little shows that pop up and the concepts...
Make sure you plug Cooking with Kev.
Cooking with Kev. Watch it. YouTube. Favorite. Like and share. Subscribe. Anyway, you know... The big thing we've been talking about is like how some of this stuff hinges on what we, you know, we refer to it jokingly as high concept, you know, like one of the plays he had seen was, and I'm not slagging on any independent playwrights.
Don't lie though, guys. There's nothing high about high concept. That is the joke.
But you know, like one of them is these two people who are dying, who are living back, like who are going back through all of their, you know, their past life and their life together as a couple and stuff, and like all, it's all done in flashbacks. And here, what it is they're already dead and they're sitting at the bottom of a lake or something. And it's like, I don't know, Kev, that sounds pretty high concept to me. The whole, I confess, the whole, you know, like, oh, a priest was a witness to the murder, but he can't say anything because of the sacred bonds of confession. Really? Really? Come on, man. That's a little bit of a high concept to swallow, don't you think? I bet they thought, they thought they were so clever when they cooked that one up.
So do Catholic priests not actually have to do that?
I believe it falls under the same jurisdiction as, like, a psychiatrist or a doctor, you know? Like, when you tell them, well, doctor...
Don't you lie now, Stephen. The Catholic priest would help you dig a hole for the body.
This is true. But
why am I doing this again, my son?
Then he make you do that thing with the, then he make you do that thing with the Catholic whip.
But then,
flagellate. I can never
pronounce that word. It's like Sischetti. Like I can't say it.
But you know, it's one of those things where like, okay, Father, we finally found the real murderer, and you're absolved of guilt. However, now we're going to charge you with obstruction of justice, which is also going to net you 5 years in the clink. Sorry, man. You know.
But it's okay.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I buy it. I buy the idea that someone believes that if someone comes and confesses their sins, that you are bound to keep that secret. What I don't buy is that then when he begins to obviously exploit that fact, and he's like, you know, it's clear that he was only confessing to entrap this guy. Well, at that point, it's not really about confession anymore.
No, and you know, the priest, Jesus Christ, Frankie, you're telling me you killed a man.
Montgomery Clift does not speak like that in this
He
movie.
Should.
For those free
speaking. Isn't that what Sean Connery sounded like in Marnie?
Jesus, Marnie. What's your problem? Jesus, Marnie, you've got a dead bird in your hair.
I'm a born American citizen of several generations. That was almost my ugly for that accent.
I was born and raised in the desert.
Oh,
Highlander! Sorry. Moving on to ugly. The ugly is what it sounds like.
We should call our uglies our Marnies.
But we can't all pick Marnie.
Oh, this is a man who's obviously a communist.
I am going to start with John.
Marnie.
No, it's not going to be Marnie. This isn't the Werner Herzog episode. I went with 1941's Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I wonder, and this keeps me
what
up.
What do you have against Brangelina?
1941.
Yes.
Did I say 1941?
Yeah.
I thought I'd thrown up my shield to defend from that. And just so everyone were clear, the Brangelina, Mr. and Miss Smith, was glorious. Fantastic. Best thing Doug Liman ever directed.
I still like
High fucking praise.
I still like Go. Go was awesome.
He is the guy who admitted that he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing.
Just poorly. Yeah, I wonder, and it keeps me up late at night, if I'm missing some crucial human element that would allow me to enjoy screwball comedies. That element's probably surviving the Depression, by the way.
Hey, this is a perfect opportunity for me to say how much Bringing Up Baby sucks again.
Yes. God, that movie sucks.
Didn't we hate on My Girl Friday or His
Girl
Friday?
No, because I...
No.
His Girl Friday is good.
Hate on the Apartment?
If anybody hated on The Apartment, I would stab them in the scrotum.
No, they get recommended to me constantly, and when people find out how much I like movies, and the results are almost always with Mr. and Mrs. Smith variety. I get annoyed by the tempo of the banter. When the two characters talking back and forth to one another, and it sounds
like you should watch this movie. See,
it's I feel like I'm watching Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, that's because Gilmore Girls is consciously evoking that.
I get annoyed by the
most precious way possible. Ugh.
I get annoyed by the pacing of the scenes, and the pacing in Mr. and Mrs. Smith is terrible, and the characters are fucking cartoons. Carol Lombard, who I would have loved to have seen as one of Hitchcock's blonde Fatales, is a spoiled, prissy little vindictive cat. Robert Montgomery's a bullish dickhead. They fight, make up. Fight when one of them says something stupid, make up. Fight when Robert Montgomery says something like Robert Montgomery, make up. And they continue to do so for 90 minutes or as long as it takes the wafer-thin story to finally give way. And the worst thing, this is what made me pick as my ugly, there is not a single frame of movie that in any way cries out that it was directed by Alfred Hitchcock.
Hmm.
And he'd been at it for a few years at this point. Like he kind of developed his look by 41. And it's just that to me makes it a definite ugly. Bad, I can forgive. Pretentious, I can forgive if it's due to ambition. Flavorless, cloying, lazy, boring, unrecognizable. Not today, Charlie. Not today.
Now, was this an early? I mean, this would have been under contract to Selznick, right?
41?
So I'm wondering if it was kind of like, here, do this. He was like, fine.
No, because I remember reading somewhere in interviews that he actually approached Carol Lombard and said he'd love to direct her in something.
Hmm. And she said, I have just the script. And then 2 years later, she died.
Oh.
Sorry. She was 33, just like Jesus.
Wow.
But as far as I know, the Romans were not involved.
Wow.
And guys, there you go. That's Mr. and Mrs. Smith perfectly. we'll talk about horrible things to avoid talking about it. Just because there's nothing. You know, be amazed as a husband and wife lock themselves in a room for 4 hours because they're not allowed to be in separate rooms until they make up.
Ugh. I've avoided seeing Mr. and Mrs.
I would have killed my wife.
I've never heard of it.
I would have killed Carol Lombard and then went to a priest and confessed about it.
Then you would have invited people over for dinner.
I would have hired a sadistic playboy to kill my wife, and then we'd both go to the priest.
And then afterwards, you'd invite people over for dinner?
Yes.
I would drink glowing milk.
We'd kill her with a frozen leg of lamb and then cook it and serve it at the dinner to get rid of the evidence.
Oh.
All right. I'm doing the unthinkable, and I'm doing my ugly before you guys get to.
Hey.
I want to talk about Family Plot. Because...
Can I have you?
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about Spellbound instead in honor of Dan Mancini, who wanted to be here, and that definitely would have been his ugly. But no, Family Plot, it's just one of those movies that is so lifeless. Surprisingly, it is also written by Ernest Lehman, who wrote the script to North by Northwest, but you would not know it. It feels nothing like a Hitchcock movie. It feels like an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and like one of the C-level episodes. You have Karen Black and Bruce Dern at their most 70s. And... you know, you have, as I recall, you know, there were zooms and weird sort of like use of long lens that felt very unlike Hitchcock, and it felt very flat. And I mean, it's not as though it wasn't recognizably one of his movies entirely. It certainly had his sense of humor. It was all about, I mean, the the title is one of his jokes, you know? It's exactly what his sense of humor was, this idea of sort of macabre comedy. But it's just these fucking people I don't care about, and psychics, and just, it feels like a Hitchcock knockoff. It feels like Z-grade Brian De Palma, like one of those times where he made a movie and accidentally forgot how stylish he could be, like The Fury or something. It's just kind of lifeless and awful.
I love The Fury. How can you call psychic powers lifeless?
The psychic powers are great, but I don't know. It feels like it was shot in second unit.
And Kirk Douglas is terrible in it.
Oh, my God. I love you, baby. When he's frozen and covered in water or something. What was that about?
Cocaine. It was about cocaine.
Positives for family plot, almost none. You do have William Devane in there, and he's always enjoyable to look at with his freak teeth. But basically,
Jesus Christ.
I don't know. It felt like it is a really sad note for him to go out on. I think maybe Hitchcock has made worse movies, but the fact that this was his last just makes it that much more disheartening.
To me, it feels like if they weren't comedies, it feels like somebody making a spoof of a Hitchcock movie.
Yeah.
Like, look how Hitchcock I can be. It's like a shitty Clue.
It is a shitty clue. That is the best way I've ever heard it described. It's a shitty Clue.
Because we all know Clue was awesome.
Clue was fantastic.
Yes.
Clue is the only other movie other than Legend
where... What was left of our listener base just to...
Tim Curry is watchable. Anyway, I've now been hypnotized by William Devane's IMDb picture, and I'm passing it over to Dave.
For I'm my checking. Ugly, I went with the other Tippi-Hedren movie, and that is The Birds.
Yay!
this is a movie that I think it's a weird conundrum. It's a silly movie, and I think that Hitchcock knew it was silly, but it's shot very seriously, and it just doesn't work. You know, it's a monster movie that it takes itself way too seriously and is missing any kind of, like, laughter or something. You know, for a good monster movie to be fun, it has to have that quality that Frank Zappa called cheapness, where that the monster movie knows that it's not great art, but this is a monster movie pretending that it's great art. And
it actually looks terrible.
Yeah, and it just doesn't work. I mean, you know, if this movie would have been directed by someone, it should have been Irwin Allen, not Alfred Hitchcock, you know? But I don't have much to say about it. I just couldn't get into it at all because the tone doesn't fit the subject at all. I mean, it's like, imagine Alfred Hitchcock could direct a Godzilla movie, and that's The Birds.
That's harsh. I remember feeling like The Birds for me is more of a bad, but it really drags. That's the biggest problem I find with it, is it's a monster movie, but it's so fucking slow. And
I just, it looks terrible.
And it really comes across like ridiculous, but like, ooh, let's try to kind of do it like in a quote unquote artsy way, and it's, I don't know, it just doesn't work for me.
The effects are
bad. It looks like the entire thing was shot as rear projection.
Yeah.
Did it need to be 2 hours long?
No.
It's like, you know, you look, did Jaws need to be as long as it did? Yes.
Yes.
Does The Birds need to be 2 hours long? No. There is 80 minutes of movie here.
And that's a perfect example. I mean, Jaws is a monster movie, and it's kind of serious, but also it has that sense of fun, and it knows that it's a monster movie, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think Hitchcock tried to inject a sense of fun, and mostly you get that in scenes like, you know, the various characters in the diner and things like that. But it just, I mean, there's nothing about Tippi Hedren's character that's at all appealing.
And people wonder why she never acted again.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost wish Ed Wood would have directed this so I could actually laugh at it, you know?
Also, what's her face from Alien when she's a little girl is incredibly irritating. She's irritating as an adult, too. But,
Cartwright?
Yeah, Veronica Cartwright.
Also, there's an actor in this named Doodles.
Also, it's a total waste of Charles McGraw, who is one of the most badasses of all time. And he's just a drunk old sea captain or something.
But, and at the same time, when you look at Hitch's chronology, it's like the tipping point. Most of the stuff that he did after the Birds was less than memorable.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you consider the fact that it came right after Psycho, I mean...
Yeah.
None of us picked it for our good, but, I mean... I would have happily chosen Psycho as my good. It is incredibly, incredibly well directed. It is just so good.
Are we talking about uglies now?
Excuse me?
It's misdirection, Steve.
Are you trying to segue into me picking Psycho as my ugly? Because that's not going to happen.
Oh, better not. Although I was very close to choosing the psychoanalysis scene in Psycho as my ugly. but
I prefer the Van Zandt version.
Stop it. Stop it. You must be stopped, and so I am turning it over to you.
Talk about misdirection. My ugly is Psycho. No, it's not really. I'm kidding.
Is it Gus Van Sant?
No. I was tempted to actually go with The Birds because I despise that movie with every fiber of my being. But I'm going to go a little more controversial because I know The Birds is kind of a take-it-or-leave-it movie anyway in the Hitchcock-O-Vere. I'm going
now,
with...
Did you say O-Vere?
O-Vere, whatever the
fuck.
Ouvre. Ouvre.
Ouvre la porte.
You're going to make
great. You, look how much ammo you've given him. He's going to be at it for weeks. Every fucking time you log into Facebook, Gabe's going to have a picture of an egg on your wall.
In his body of work. We'll leave it at that. That's what I get for trying to act fancy. I should have known better.
I'm going to do what I did. Go to that YouTube channel that teaches you how to pronounce things. How do you think I learned ancillary for tonight?
Ancillary. Just for the record, we say oeuvre.
Oeuvre. We say oeuvre.
What is your ugly?
My ugly is rope.
Oh, that's... I was anticipating having to yell "fuck you" into the mic.
Okay, but, you're not. Okay, no, well that's good.
No, that's fine.
I fucking hate that movie, man. I really do. Like Smug Jackasses and
roll the R when you say the title, though.
Rope.
Rope. Rope-a-dope.
Rope.
I just I'm not a fan. I don't understand or appreciate what it was he was trying to do there. I don't consider it to be clever or artistic in any way. I don't particularly consider it to be well acted.
Okay.
So is it more visually pretentious than Torn Curtain?
Yes, definitely.
John Dahl is fucking terrible.
Thank you.
It is one of the worst performances I've ever seen. Farley Granger, I have to say, was very good. And I think he's actually... he seems a bit more natural and has more range than I would suspect from Strangers on a Train in this. But John Dahl is just...
awful.
Hey, there's an actor named Douglas Dick.
Oh, man, imagine if you combine that in Doodles, and if it's Doodles Dick.
Dick Doodles. We call him Richard on the set. Yeah, no. Rope is just God. Like,
I kind of like the idea of these guys seeing if they can doing something to see if they can get away with it, but it immediately goes, first of all, as a technical exercise, it's just ridiculous. And second of all, it immediately amps to 11 on a melodrama scale.
Yeah.
It's like, how did they ever start this if one of them was going to fall to pieces? Like,
Edgar Allan Poe did it so much better.
Yeah.
And that only worked because it had the inner monologue. You know, it was just,
I understand his wanting to do this. I understand, the idea of being interested in this concept. And I understand sort of musing on the idea of, hey, what if I did a movie in quote-unquote one shot?
Yeah.
But to have gotten all the way through to production and still decide it was a good idea when he knew what he was going to have to do, like zoom in, like super obviously on people's backs and things like that. If you're going to make a movie in one shot, you know, maybe people should notice, but also you want to be unobtrusive about it. You don't want to every 9 minutes go, this movie is one single shot.
And what blows me away even more about it is, you know, back in the mid to late 90s when I was a young upcoming film snob with a whole bunch of friends who did film courses and all of that fun jazz, this movie was considered brilliant. People went on about
brilliant.
How brilliant it was and how
brilliant.
Much of a misunderstood and underrated classic it was. And I sit down and watch it as part of this...
More Pinot Noir?
More Chardonnay?
I'm kind of surprised. I remember, it seems to me, my experiences with its reputation is that it was kind of misguided. But... I mean, it's certainly I watched it. I found a couple of things to like about it, but mostly, I mean, it's the kind of movie where I kind of haven't thought about it since I saw it.
I think it's a prime example of one of those movies that everybody hated. So 40 years later, it became the one that everybody loved, you know, for that.
Oh, you mean Vertigo?
Yeah. Another fine example right there. But yeah, no, it's just such a terribly executed movie, like on all counts, you know, it's.
The one thing I'll say for it as its place in his body of work is that it is evidence that he was, you know, he was working in the mainstream, but he was really experimental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least you can say that about Rope. At least you can say that it's like clearly he was willing to take huge, huge chances.
This was going to be my defense of Spellbound.
The huge risk I'm taking in this is the terrible script. Can a great movie be made with an awful, awful script?
No!
That's entirely psychobabble and has a terribly miscast Gregory Peck. No, it can't. Dolly!
Ugh.
Yeah, at least Spellbound had those dream sequences. But
yeah.
Anyway. All right. Any more thoughts on Rope?
I haven't seen it.
It's terrible.
All right. Rope. Hang yourself with it. Final thoughts on Alfred Hitchcock.
Ooh. Pick me.
Gabe?
I mean, I think that Hitchcock is well deservedly recognized as a master of the genre, but at the same time, I feel that he has maybe like, you know, 10 movies or so that I consider really, really great, and they are really, really great. But I guess the majority of his stuff that I've seen, I would place under the bad. You know, aura, maybe because he was restricted by the studio, or he was trying to experiment too much, or whatever.
He was whatever. Just a coot.
He was just a coot. He was actually Anthony Hopkins in a fat suit. Did you know that?
I mean, this guy, when he was on, and he could direct a movie like nobody else's business. And I mean, you know, he's not known as a master of suspense for nothing. So there's incredibly gripping sequences that he accomplished with basically, you know, nothing. As in, like, there's not that much that he does to do the suspense. It's just working with basic stuff. And I think that's what I like about Hitchcock. Despite his later flourishes and stuff, what I like most is when he was pared down and he could just cut to the meat, you know, when he was working with a scalpel.
What I would say about Hitchcock is that, especially for modern audiences, many of his movies probably suffer from the reputation of Master of Suspense. Because suspense or tension wasn't always what he was going for. Also, I would say that I would be hard pressed to think of someone who was more consistently experimental, who was such a visual innovator. I think probably compared to the other three of you, I probably like Hitchcock a bit more on balance, but I certainly will acknowledge that he had his share of misfires. But man, the guy was just constantly
working.
You know, he had just this imagination that would not stop. He could visualize an entire movie in his head. You know, there's a famous thing that he said, which was shooting the movie is the most boring part because he's already seen it once.
Yeah.
Right. Like he's earned his reputation entirely. And I would say working in the system he was working in, he has a more than respectful oeuvre.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Hitchcock working in the 70s liberation?
You know, if he was a young man.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't like these movies with the fast cars and the sex and the blood everywhere.
It sounds like he was born and raised in the desert. Possibly a Spaniard or an Egyptian. But yeah, I mean, I think the guy, I would happily say that the guy, you know, for his various misfires, is really one of the greatest directors that there ever was.
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, although I say, you know, like it's nothing. He only has 10 masterpieces.
Yeah, exactly. Only 10 movies that could easily go in anyone's top five. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
All right, John, any final thoughts?
Yeah, there's it's going to seem really, really cliche because I'm going to give the exact advice that I was given to Danny DeVito and Throw Mama from the Train. Anyone who's got any interest in writing or telling stories should check out Hitchcock movies on plot development.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a, there's only so many stories out there, right? Mm. But this guy had a interesting way. His movies always had these interesting ways of telling the story that just made it feel immediately fresh.
He was constantly trying to subvert expectations.
Yeah,
definitely.
Sometimes it worked, and sometimes you got rope.
But sometimes you got psycho.
Exactly.
Sometimes you got William Devane.
William Devane was awesome in Payback.
He's the best part of Payback.
I get confused during Hollow Man trying to decide which one's got bigger teeth here.
I would say probably his biggest weakness is...
We talking about Hitchcock or William Devane? Yeah.
William Devane, obviously his biggest weakness is sugary foods. But
oh man,
Hitchcock, I would say that he was too interested in the themes and the images and the development of the plot to the point where too often he would lose the humanity of his stories. But most of the time, who cared? And also, I mean, that's not to say that he didn't do great stories about interesting people and get great performances.
Yeah,
people.
I mean,
certainly did.
I think that that's a, you know, it's a quote unquote weak point, but there's a lot of movies that you know that they end up feeling more like a technical exercise than an actual movie.
And I mean, people talk about how important casting is. I think it was doubly important in Hitchcock movies.
Yeah, because to him, actors were an afterthought. You know, like he had.
Did I say actors should be? Did I say actors were cattle? No, what I meant was actors should be treated like cattle.
Yeah.
Any additional thoughts, Steve?
I will say that Hitchcock for me is one of those very, very rare. I think there are maybe two or three directors in the entire medium that Hitchcock ranks with, you know, like there's he and Wells. I mean, Hitchcock basically was Wells with considerably less crazy.
Wow. Less crazy?
Less crazy than Wells, yeah, considerably. But, you know, it's a situation where the man is renowned and justifiably so. The guy earned his reputation. He's made some out-and-out masterpieces. But I think that a lot of the directors he influenced and who brought strengths in from other sources. I'm thinking of one in particular. John, you know exactly who I'm thinking about. But, you know, he took the best of Hitchcock. He took the best of Lean.
Is it Chris Columbus?
No.
Oh,
is it DJ Caruso?
But, is it Brian De Palma?
I think there's at least one other director out there. You know, if Alfred Hitchcock is the Bobby Orr of the film world, to go Canadian on you guys for a second, then Steven Spielberg is the Wayne Gretzky. You know, he took what...
And I'm the Andre the Giant.
So does that make Francis Ford Coppola Marc Messier?
Sure. Sure it does. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think without Hitchcock, film couldn't have evolved the way it did. But I think he laid the trail for more people to follow. And I think a lot of what came because of what Hitchcock created was... I don't want to use the word the more worthy to remember because it's not really the case. I mean, like the guy was an invaluable contributor to the language of film, but I think that his contribution was more on the technical side than the films that he created, if that makes any sense to you.
Oh, so he's Jack Kirby.
Sure. Yeah, there we go.
Gabe's going to beat me to death.
Yes.
Except, you know, some of Hitchcock's movies had good dialogue.
Some of. And I have to
leave the brow alone. It wasn't his fault.
Which one was the dance with the prison warden? Which movie was that?
Dance with the prison warden?
You know, it's been parodied in a bunch of other stuff.
I think that was you in juvie.
No. No. They're trying to seduce the warden to get the key to the prison cell or something. That was a Hitchcock flick, wasn't it? Help me out here.
I'm drawing a blank, probably. It was probably one we talked about, but I don't remember anything. I'm just here for the money.
Why are you here, Andrew?
By the way, I've been meaning to tell you, the royalties are really slow.
We've got to turn a profit first.
We are digging for oil, right?
Sure.
I drink your milkshake.
I had this strange idea that if Francis Ford Coppola is Marc Messier, then instead of, you know, selling Lay's, he's selling wine, and he's like, bet you can't drink just one, which explains his film career lately.
So George Lucas is what, the Paul Coffey?
Oh, man, George Lucas is totally Cam Neely. Who's the guy who used to play for Detroit? It was Probert.
Bob Probert.
Isn't George Lucas Don Cherry and he's wearing those collars to support his freakish toad neck?
We We already had an episode about George.
John Milius would be Bob Probert, man.
So that makes Fritz Lang Maurice Richard?
No. Lang's too early.
We're confusing our American listeners.
Oh, yeah, so, you know, hey, Hitchcock, great, great, great technical director, valuable contribution to the world of cinema.
Yeah, I was going to say that often, sometimes reading his interviews, especially that book that François Truffaut made with him, is sometimes more interesting than watching some of his movies.
We're ending this on a downer, guys. I mean, we do have to just, I think as the final thing, we have to acknowledge that the guy was just fucking amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a genius.
Fuck it, we're done. See you next Wednesday.
Who are we doing? No, wait, we got to announce what we're doing, what our next episode is.
Yeah, what are we doing next, John?
And it's the complete, well, I'm not even going to say it's complete opposite, because this guy is just as important as Alfred Hitchcock to the visuals of movie making. He recently, I can't say sadly passed away, because, I mean, the man did live to his 80s, didn't he?
Yeah.
We're going to take a look at the life and films of stuntman turned director Hal Needham.
Woo!
Deeds, not words.
Swish. So I guess all that's left to say.
See you next Wednesday.